Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the Class of 2005. Here at the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Fryer family. This week, we're speaking with Terry Sinnott of the Class of 1994. Terry definitely has an unusual LinkedIn profile for a PC alum. He's worked as a journalist, and he also performed for four seasons as a skateboard artist for Cirque du Soleil at Madison Square Garden. These days, after his day job in higher education advancement, Terry runs Mode Skateboards with his wife, Jenna, screen printing decks in Jacksonville, Florida. Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, could you tell us how you got started skateboarding?
Yeah, I was, seventh grade, and my younger brother had skated first. This is going back to late 1984. And he wanted a skateboard for Christmas. And as soon as he got one, I decided I wanted to have one. I think the pivotal point was watching a VHS tape that we rented from the local grocery store. So this would be Christmas week, 1984. And the video was probably so out of date at the time, but it was also brand new to me. I think it was probably filmed late 70s, 79, 80, but to me it looked current. I didn't know the difference. I was in seventh grade, I think. And that's really just how I started. I saved up enough allowance money, and we went down to, my mom took me on a Thursday afternoon, March 7th, 1985, to Doo-Wop Records in Newport, Rhode Island, and I bought a skateboard, and I've been skating ever since. So I don't know, what's that, like 35 years, I guess.
But you've got a pretty unique skateboarding style. I think most people picture kind of like Tony Hawk half pipe things. Tell us about your skateboarding.
Yeah, it's all flat ground freestyle. So it's more or less a niche. It's been around since the beginning of skateboarding, essentially. But as skate parks were first built in the mid 1970s, freestyle kind of started to get phased out. And it didn't really ever go away. I started in 85, and there was contests up through about 1991, I'd say. And it was covered in the magazines and in mainstream skateboard videos at the time. And around 1991, it sort of went underground. And there was about a good 10-year period in time where you couldn't buy equipment like that. You couldn't find it in skate. I mean, nowadays, you still can't find it actually in skate shops because it still is pretty unique. It doesn't sound like it should be because all it is flat ground skateboarding, no obstacles. It's a lot of board flips, rotation tricks, spinning, handstand related tricks, things like that. But the key point is that it's just you and the flat ground.
So no grinding on curbs and
benches. That sort of skateboarding I've always done at different points in my life, but it's not really the sort of fit. If I want to skate with friends, I'll go to the skate park and skate the bowls. But normally I stick to freestyle because that's what I like the most.
Well, Terry, this is the question I think we've been dying to ask you. Most people joke about quitting their day job and joining the circus, but you actually did it. Yeah. How did you take that leap?
It was... Okay, at the time, I had been working, I think I had worked about 12 years as a newspaper reporter at that time at different daily papers. I was in Gloucester, Massachusetts, first at the Gloucester Daily Times, then I was in Newport, Rhode Island for about 8 years, and then I was a copy editor in Fall River, Massachusetts at the Fall River Herald News, and we worked an evening shift. I can remember the call on my cell phone, my flip phone of all things, because this would have been, I think this was February of 2007. I had a call from a casting director who had a French-Canadian accent. She claimed she was in Montreal, was with Cirque du Soleil, and she had seen a YouTube video of me skateboarding and was pitching a new show that they had and wanted to see if I would be interested in it. And at the time, I was aware that Cirque du Soleil existed, but I didn't actually understand. I thought they were one-off shows. I didn't realize they had shows that were at a theater on a certain schedule. Like, I didn't realize the sort of business and that it was. I But I remember hearing it and wondering if this was a legitimate phone call. That was my first thought: is somebody playing a practical joke on me? And but then when I logged into my email, I had the same message from the same woman that not only had she emailed me, she had called me, and I thought, maybe this is real. And I remember I probably got home, because we worked an evening shift laying out the newspaper. So I think I probably got home sometime after like 1:30 in the morning. And I'm pretty sure my wife was asleep, but I remember telling her about this. And I must have followed up. This, it was sort of like, it didn't happen right away in terms of me accepting the role or even being offered the role. They were just kind of reaching out to gauge interest if you'd be willing to do it. So for me, it was a 2-year commitment when they first offered it to me. They knew the show would be at the theater at Madison Square Garden. So what was going through my head was like, what will I do after that show ends? It ended up going for 4 years, but at the time I was thinking like, okay, I know what I can be doing for 2 years. Do I want to quit a job that I really like? So that was the dilemma I had at the time. And I just remember my first question was, well, how much does it pay? And the woman said, oh, it doesn't, don't worry about pay. You can, and I said, well, it's kind of important for me to make the decision. She says, we're just trying to figure out if you're interested. And I said, well, I don't know if I'm interested if I don't know what it actually pays. So once we got over that hurdle and I confirmed my interest, they were looking at a couple of my friends too, because it's a small community. It was a freestyler in Germany that I knew, and one of my friends in Sweden, and another skateboarder in Montreal. So we were all in contact, and we had all been contacted. And I don't know, I'm still not clear who expressed interest, but they eventually offered it to me. So I think I left after we negotiated everything, and I decided like, okay, I can quit my job and I'll figure out what I'll do afterwards. So yeah, that's sort of how it came about. Cause at that point in time, I had been doing a lot of skateboard contests and mostly a lot of demonstrations. I was doing demos with a bike company. There were sort of things at trade shows and things like that. So I was just doing it for extra money on the side. And I wasn't seriously trying to pursue that. That wasn't something I thought of doing at all. I can remember my parents, though, actually, at first not being very upset that I was joining the circus. They came around to loving the idea as soon as they learned more about it. But I feel like at first they thought it was very risky to do something like that, to leaving a job that you like.
I can see why they would be hesitant, yeah. But it's great to hear that they came around, and I'm sure they came to see your performances.
Oh yeah, yeah, they came each year. So we would go up. We were involved in the creation of the show, really, which is unusual. Cirque does create a lot of different shows, but a lot of times they have existing shows. Like in Vegas, they might have 4 or 5, and their injuries a lot of times are what bring different gymnasts into the shows. Say somebody is doing a power track act and a gymnast gets hurt, they bring those people in. So your role is already predetermined. You don't have a lot of flexibility to kind of create how the show is going to evolve. So we were brought in. We had to go up to Montreal the summer of 2007, and we spent months living up there as they were creating the show, learning how to do all sorts of stuff that never got included in the show. They had, because they don't just use you for the act that you're actually doing. My skateboarding was the first 10 minutes of the show with a group of other, there's one other skateboarder, BMX people, bike riders, like a professional rope skipper. We were all part of the same act, but then they use you throughout the whole entire show. I was dressed as a DPW worker during a windstorm, grabbing garbage cans off the stage, and dressed as a purse. This is actually funny. The show is a winter themed show, and it's about this little kid wondering why it's not snowing. And the second act, they travel to this mystical place where the people of the north live. So that we were dressed in the second act in these almost tribal-like costumes doing different skits and things that had absolutely nothing to do with skateboarding. So they use everybody throughout the entire show. You're engaged in the whole show. But really, in my mind, the first 10 minutes was the most important to me, and then I could relax after that, and the rest of the show was kind of fun.
So, Terry, before you joined the circus, before you joined Cirque, did you have a lot of performance experience?
No. Well, I had been in skateboard contests, and I'd been doing a lot of demos, but that's a much more introverted atmosphere. You're looking down at your skateboard the whole time. That's the way I skate normally. The board is at my feet. My focus is headed down. I usually have my headphones on. And so Cirque was sort of a wake-up call to that, where the audience, especially at the theater at Madison Square Garden, they're all, it's not in a round, they're all in the front of the stage. So there's a time where I would spin like 360s on my skateboard, sort of like a figure skater, and you spin around like 20 sometimes. And I had to learn how to stop so I was facing the audience. I couldn't just, in a normal skateboard contest, I could just spin until I run out of momentum. But in that environment, you had to make sure you were landing all your tricks with that focus ahead of you. Because otherwise it just, you were sort of becoming an introvert on stage, and naturally that's how I am. So that sort of was hard at first, to figure out how to time what you're doing so you could acknowledge the crowd and look up. But I enjoyed doing it, but it was not something that I was used to doing at all.
What else surprised you or about the experience with Cirque?
I was surprised how much emphasis is on things that seem less important than skateboarding or whatever it is that your act is. They put a large amount of focus on your makeup. You learn how to do the makeup yourself. So before each show, call time might be like at 9:15 and the show's at 11. It would almost take me an hour and 15 to 20 minutes to complete my makeup, because you're doing it in two steps. You're putting powders and creams on so that it's going to wear off once you start sweating and running around. But they put a lot of emphasis on your makeup, and they actually periodically send the makeup artists to the shows to keep an eye and make sure people aren't getting lazy and skipping steps. So you get critiqued along the way. And I had a costume that was very restrictive. It was heavy. It looked like a bumblebee coat. It had way too much weight on it. And the hood a lot of my tricks, I was upside down. The hood would always go over your head. So instead of removing the hood or making it lighter, they would pin the hood to the back of my coat. They pin it to your pants so that it doesn't ride up as you're upside down. So I was actually surprised how important they map this all out ahead of time. They want the character to have a certain look. This is the character's costume. And then you don't really have a lot of flexibility in getting that change. You just have to adapt and work with it. So that surprised me, because in my mind, I thought if I fall off my skateboard, that's going to be much more noticeable if compared to whether my, you know, eyeliner isn't done properly.
And definitely not something you'd expect.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, not at all. But we had some great, we had a lot of, I think the show would run during the holiday season. So like it was 6 months of work a year for 4 years. And we always showed up around July for training. And then the shows usually were October, November, December, and part of January. And it was a lot of fun, like doing the shows, because every day there was different people in the audience. Like President Clinton and Hillary and Chelsea came to one show. Another show, the drummer from U2 was there. Another show, it was Beyonce and her sister. So like there was always like especially I think because it was in New York City, there was this revolving door of like entertainers that were in the audience, and they'd come backstage after the show, so you got to meet them. The only time it actually made me nervous though was when I knew where President Clinton was seated normally I had no idea where anybody was seated, but the day he arrived, we didn't know until 5 minutes before the show started. One of the stage managers said, "Oh, the Clintons are here." And then like within like a minute, I was still warming up on stage with the curtain down, and the theater is just darkness on the other side of the curtain, and people are still coming into their seats. And you could tell where the Clintons were being seated because they were with their Secret Service detail and guiding them with flashlights to their seats. And then there, you could hear like this hush in the crowd and everybody kind of gasping that when they recognized who they were. And now there's 5,600 people in the theater, but I know exactly where these three people are seated. So my focus, unfortunately, is on where these three people are seated. And it makes you really conscious of, I can remember like overthinking everything I was doing to make sure you had proper form when you were doing it. Things that I take for granted that you don't even think about. But I don't know if other performers went through the same thing, but that was kind of how I was handling it.
That's amazing that it just sort of shifted your whole mood that whole night. Three people out of 5,600, right?
50. Yeah, I'm sure you're not supposed to be playing to three people, but that it was hard. It was hard knowing exactly where they were seated, so you were aware of that, and you were. It was fun during other elements of the show to be able to look out when it wasn't so important to make sure you land your tricks or whatever you're doing, where you have the flexibility of enjoying being on stage and interacting with the other people that are on stage. And then you had moments where you could actually look out and see if you could spot them and stuff like that. So that was enjoyable.
After those four seasons were done, tell us how you transitioned back to real life.
Well, during the off season of Cirque, so the year one ended in January of 2008. And I thought I went not going back to work until July. So I was wondering what I was going to do. And it didn't seem feasible to go back and get a reporting job or copy editing job for just 6 months, knowing that I was going to be leaving again. But my friend was working on the film Shutter Island that was filming in Boston, the Leonardo DiCaprio, Martin Scorsese film. And he had said to me, like, get your resume together with anything art related that you can put on it, and I'll try to get you on the overhire list because it's a union, the United Scenic Artists Local 829 job. And I got on the overhire list. I ended up working on that show for 5 months. That was like probably the best job I've ever had. Not that particular film, but I ended up doing a number of other films for like the next, I did Cirque, and then in the off season, every year of Cirque, I worked on different movies. So I got to work on the Ben Affleck movie, The Town, that was filming in Boston, the Wes Anderson film, Moonrise Kingdom, that filmed in Newport and Jamestown, Rhode Island. And at some point in time, I learned enough I would bring my reporter notepad to work every day in my back pocket. Nobody else had their notepad in their back pocket, but I would go and we learned how to do faux marble and faux wood grain and faux brick finishes, because everything that you see on a movie set is fake. So that's what I ended up doing in the off season of Cirque. And so I still didn't go back to a traditional desk job. And then when Cirque ended at the end of January 2011, I gave one full year of movie work. And it's a tiring schedule because I was living in New Bedford, Massachusetts at the time, and all the work was either north of Boston or right in Boston. And you'd had to leave your house at like 5 a.m. to get there for a 7 o'clock start time. And then you didn't get out until like 6 o'clock at night. And then it takes you 2 hours to get home. And you got to go so you're home at 8, you're going to bed at 10:15 and getting no sleep. I did that for a long time. Like I did 5 years of set painting, and I still pay my union dues because I'm not convinced I will never want to go back to that work. But at some point in time, I was thinking, this doesn't seem sustainable. Like you can never be in the right place. You never live in the right place where the next production is going to be. So it always involves a really long commute or staying in hotels, and I didn't want to do that. So I was considering going back to being a newspaper reporter, because that's really what I had planned to do my whole life. And somewhere along the line, I thought, I had done an internship at the Providence College communications office for about 6 months after I graduated. So I had looked to see what PC had for jobs, and I saw a prospect researcher position in institutional advancement. And the main thing that caught my eye was it said something about electronic research. And I thought, well, that's one element of being a reporter. And I didn't understand what prospect research was at the time, but I decided to apply for that job and ended up getting it. And that's kind of how I ended up back to having a day job at a desk.
Excellent. Without a crazy 2-hour commute at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was fun, cause I was back at Providence College and it had changed so much. So I graduated in 94 and I think I started there in April of 2012. So many buildings were either under construction or had evolved since, you know, like the core of the campus was there, but it still seemed familiar, but it was nice to see it evolving too.
After CERC, I think that's when you started your business. Could you tell us about Mode and the skateboards you design in ScreenPrint?
Yeah. So Mode Skateboards is a company that I do with my wife, Jenna, and she's a graphic designer, and I learned how to screen print the boards when I was kind of inspired by, once I was set painting, and it sort of reopened things in my mind that I had forgotten about doing, like drawing and painting and things like that. Things that I always loved to do as a kid going through high school that I didn't take a lot of classes in after that. So, I've really found that I enjoyed making things with my hands while I was set painting. And then the skateboarding kind of was a natural combination of my interest in doing that and skateboarding. The only problem was I had never screen printed in my life, and you're printing on a curved, it's a convex, skateboards have concave, but on the flip side, when they're flipped upside down, they're convex. So the screen isn't hitting if you were screen printing posters or t-shirts, you're doing it flat. I'm printing down the nose and the tail of the boards and with the contours. So that was sort of a learning process. But to this day, we started making our first boards in 2010. We're still doing it. I kind of just decided we were going to screen print them all ourselves. We've never done any that we haven't actually screen printed ourselves. And most of the graphics are designed by my wife, Jenna, although there's a few that we've used friends and things to do. And we have a small team of skateboarders that are around the country that are part of the team. I send them wheels and boards and things like that. And it takes up a lot of my evenings. Like usually I get home from work and I have orders to process or sometimes orders that come in that I have that color of the board available on the website, but I don't actually have it in stock. And I'm sitting at work and I'm thinking, I wonder if I have this at home, like, or am I gonna have to make it really fast? So that's like, we kind of just do Mode on the side for fun. And I go to the post office almost every day on my lunch break. So having a stable work schedule where I have that flexibility works out well. Like I'm not working evenings anymore, like when I was a newspaper reporter covering meetings and stuff. So Mode sort of evolved based on what I was doing at the time and my interest in making things.
You know, this all started with your love of skateboarding though. And do you have time, you know, with fulfilling orders and everything else and your day job to still get out on your board every day?
No, I don't go every day, but I don't miss a Saturday or Sunday. Like it's a given I go and skate Saturday and Sunday. I usually go for about 2 hours. I might go midweek, like on a Wednesday or so, but I'm down to 2 to 3 days a week. Whereas probably my most of my life, I think I at least went 6 days a week, especially the time leading up to Cirque du Soleil. I was probably going like 7 days a week for years on end. So right now I'm down to like just doing 2 days because there just isn't enough time, because I like doing other exercise too. So we like to walk after work, and because we're down in Florida now, so like it's nice most evenings to go for a walk. So I'm happy though with going twice a week is good enough for me. I'm still able to learn some new things, and that's what I like about skateboarding, is coming up with new ideas and creating new tricks or combinations and stuff. That's kind of what motivates me. That's pretty much, I think, how I've always liked doing it, because I like that discovery process of figuring it out.
Like working through them, like actually executing, you've got this idea and how to.
Yeah, and seeing like, oh, I've seen this kind of footwork done by somebody else, but I wonder if I can combine that with this. And then like, it's a lot of steps along the way that can go wrong. Like everything has to line up properly to make it work. But like, I enjoy that process. And then over time, it becomes like muscle memory, and you do it without, you can turn your brain off and not be thinking about it. But yeah, like that's sort of what really motivates me to like skateboarding, is continuing to learn, because I hope to be able to learn my whole life. Like you have to evolve though in your learning process too. Like I've had shoulder injuries for 2000, I'd say about 4 years straight, I had like frozen shoulder, first on one side and then on the other side. And that took away all my handstand tricks that I had grown accustomed to doing. So I started, but you just start to work on the things where that don't involve your arms in skateboarding. Like you just have a different focus, so you progress in a different direction. Now my shoulders feel fine. So hopefully I can work back on that sort of stuff. But, you know, I am 48 years old. I have friends that are in their 60s who are still skating and still learning stuff. So I find that inspiring to know that you can continue to do it. But it is concrete. So sometimes I wonder, like, would I be better off if I just surfed and not skated? Because if I really want to stay active doing this until, like, you know, like into my late 70s or 80-ish or something, I wonder like how sustainable it is. But because of the evolution of the growth of skateboarding, like nobody really skated prior to the 1960s, and it was a fad, like the hula hoop. I'd say in the mid 70s, like 1976, is the next wave of skateboarding. So you have a good amount of people who might have been 18, or I'd say 14 to 20 in 76, who are now in their, they're about 60 now, and they're still skating. So when I was a kid, if you saw anybody at age 30 and that was skating, it was unheard of. So it's sort of interesting to see that evolution and realize like there's no reason to stop.
Right. Having, going in your 25th college reunion is not a reason to hang up your board.
No.
So just thinking about PC, I mean, you've had such a variety of careers, and you're still pursuing, you know, all this different creative work. What did you learn at PC that helped you in this process?
I really, especially this, in today where you hear just so much about STEM education, while it's important, and I like that focus, what I appreciated about PC was it seemed very well-rounded. You weren't just learning whatever it is that you were, whatever your major was. I was a political science major, but you needed to take all these other, you were taking Western, 20 credits of Western civilization. To me, those were some of the best classes I ever had. I didn't probably appreciate it when I was in the thick of it. Like you were constantly having to read over 100 pages each night just to stay on top of it. But that interdisciplinary approach, I really liked, because when you're studying the Renaissance in literature, you're also studying it with an art history professor or a history professor of religion, and what was going on in the world was influencing art, literature, politics, war, you know, like religion, everything. Like that sort of education is different if I were to compare it to how my wife went to school, where she was a graphic designer, and it was a very technical education where you were learning how to use programs and things like that, but you weren't necessarily getting the appreciation for the different movements in art history. So sometimes, like, we'll be discussing things, and she has like a great understanding of all the techniques, but she may not have been exposed to like Dadaism or different waves of, you know, like the Dadaist art movement, and then how that affected like William Burroughs' literature. And to me, I think like that PC education is something that I really appreciate. And while I, like I said, reading 100 pages a night, I didn't appreciate it at the time, but in retrospect, it didn't take long to appreciate it. I think within like a couple of years, I definitely was realizing that what you were getting there at PC was special.
Terry, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good getting connected again with PC.
Subscribe to the Providence College Podcast in all the usual places, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and our newest platform, Spotify. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.